Kate, thank you very much indeed. And a reminder now that our regular probate expert, Solicitor Elaine Byrne, will be joining me on tomorrow's show. She'll be answering listeners' questions. So if you have any queries for Elaine about wills, inheritance, probate, any of the complications that go along with those, do get in touch now. You can email us todaycb@rte.ie and Elaine will be with us tomorrow. Now, though, things went from bad to worse for Chelsea over the weekend. Brentford beat them 4-1, beating them for the first time since 1939. And they can only look on as Liverpool and Man City vie for the Premier League title. And with the World Cup draw throwing up some really interesting showdowns, who better to talk to today than soccer journalist and pundit Guillaume Balague. Guillaume, good morning.
Good morning, Claire.
Good to talk to you. So Liverpool and Man City, they both won over the weekend. It's a really tight title race now between this moment and the end of the season. What's your take on who can come out on top here?
The first thing to say is that it's great to have a title race, because if you remember, mid-January when City beat Chelsea, City were 14 points away from Liverpool, even though
That's
Liverpool
right.
had a couple of games in hand. And now we can compare it to that season, great season of 2018-19, where they were also separated by 1 point after 30 games, exactly as now, with a difference, of course, that on Sunday, Manchester City meet Liverpool, which didn't happen those years back. But yes, it's an exciting end of the season. I've spoken to the City coach and staff. They said the important game is not so much the Atletico Madrid one in the Champions League on Tuesday. It's important, but the big one is the Liverpool one. And the thing that fascinates me about these moments is how do players and managers deal with pressure? And they're telling me both sides, players have been here before. They played finals. They know why they're winning or they're losing. If City don't manage to get the 3 points against Crystal Palace or Southampton, they know that they still create enough. They're fine. All right, okay. So they have the mind for it. How about the managers? And this is fascinating. Fascinating this is because...
Yeah, because we have two really impressive managers. They have impressive CVs. They're both very charismatic, Klopp and Guardiola. He was saying that Man City are in for a proper battle with Liverpool. It's just, I always love this, the games that they play beforehand, you know, the lines that they put out there. Who has the upper hand in your view at this stage?
I do think that Liverpool seem a little bit tired. They showed that against Inter, but they're so efficient. They showed that against West Ham as well. Not so much against Watford this weekend, but they seem a little bit physically. Salah, for instance, seems affected by being knocked out of the World Cup. But in any case, yes, they do play mind games, don't they? And I do feel that they count for nothing, those mind games. It's good for us. It's good for the media.
It's good fun, isn't it?
It's good fun, that's all. But I did ask both managers in recent times, how do you deal with these situations? And, you know, it's a solitary place to be a manager because they have to feel the opposite than everyone else. If everybody is excited, they have to be calm. And they have to turn whatever feeling that is around, they'd have to turn it around. So they're telling the players, enjoy the pressure. And of course, they have to trust the process. They cannot do anything mad or do anything completely different. So it is a great time for them. It's what they're in this business for.
Listen, talking about pressure, Chelsea 4-1 loss at home to Brentford. I mean, obviously, look, it sums up really the woes of that club in the past couple of weeks.
The thing is, though, I think victories and defeats are the big imposters, because victories always require celebrations, even though if he hides the problems, and defeats always demands explanations, even though it just blurs the context. Because you know what? After the sanctions to Abramovich, Chelsea had won 6 games. They had not lost for 15. They were in a good place. It's just that perhaps they changed too many things, as we were saying earlier about Klopp and Pep Guardiola, trying to just keep calm and not changing things. But here, Tuchel did a completely different change of system, put different players to the usual ones and the ones that will face the game against Real Madrid. It just didn't work out. Bad day in the office, because remember, they're still in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, Chelsea, in the semi-finals of the FA Cup, and they have Crystal Palace, so, you know, close to the final. And they should be top four. So in the big context, they're not bad. They're okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you look at the big picture, of course, Thomas Tuchel, he was praised for how he dealt with questions about Roman Abramovich in recent weeks. Maybe not at the beginning, but he gave more fuller answers in the last couple of weeks. But he's had personal issues as well. I see that he's going through a relationship breakup. That's not going to help either.
I imagine he won't, and it's one of those things that that I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often, I have to be honest. You talk to every manager, and you know that they are there when they are with the family, sharing the days off, but they're not there. They have their head in football all the time. And every manager tells you the same. You have to have a partner that understands that when the football season is on, they're not going to get much of their partner. And
yes,
also, there is always a promise. They promise things. Do you know, when I finish this season, we're definitely going to go to that trip that we talked about, but they hardly ever deliver. So really, partners of managers have to be really patient.
Yeah, it's very intense. What's your take on what the future holds for Chelsea in the post-Abramovich era? The Ricketts family, they own the Chicago Cubs in the States. They're said to be on the shortlist to buy the club. They're making all sorts of commitments to the fans, but the supporters, it seems so far, are not happy with this.
No, they protested. I think there is evidence that they have shown or have done racist remarks, which are not being forgiven by the fans. I think that's fair enough. It's a time to show their opinion, which, by the way, perhaps at the end it matters less than they would like it to be. But in any case, they have left it a little bit harder for the decision makers, which really are just Abramovich in the background, who will decide first out of the four contenders in the show list. All of them American money, to see which one actually becomes the winner of this. And then it's the government who eventually has to approve, and also the Premier League. So the process is still ongoing. And it means that there will be investment, because they all been forced to say that they have £1 billion available to invest in the club. Enough investment for Chelsea to stay right at the top.
It's very uncertain, isn't it, for the players? And I know you were saying there that, you know, in the case of Man City and Liverpool, that the players just get on with it. They're used to the pressure. Do you think any of this noise around Chelsea will impact how the players perform?
No doubt. And maybe not in the short term, but certainly uncertainty is the worst thing that you can put in the brain of players and coaches. And what's happening now is that, look at the case of Azpilicueta. The club automatically can renew his contract without him having a say to it. That's what the contract says, and that's what the club has said. But he's thinking, but I don't know what the club is going to be like next season. So you're asking me to stay, but I'm not sure I want to stay. Rudiger, whose contract finishes at the end of the season, also wants to go. Christiansen is moving to Barcelona. So yeah, there will be changes because nobody knows exactly what's going to come next.
I really want to ask you about Gareth Bale, the Welsh captain. He got plenty of abuse from some elements of the Spanish media. He was called a parasite in one column. Explain to us what's happening there. What's the reason for the harshness towards the Real Madrid player?
Gareth Bale did not come to Real Madrid not wanting to play every week. But for the last 3-4 years, that's exactly how he feels. He felt ill-treated by Zinedine Zidane, his manager. He felt there was no protection from the club, that the fans did not understand him, and that the press were against him. Not at the beginning, but when everybody decided that he was the villain of this piece. And nobody in Spain has had a look at his amazing goal scoring record, the fact that he scored key goals in his finals, and also to his mental health. Has anybody wondered how he feels? Because right now he's the foreigner who is displaced, who is ill-treated. Has anybody wondered what he's going through? Basically, as I said, 3-4 years ago, he said, do you know what? I just don't fancy football. I don't want to be here. The contract was a big contract. Decided to continue playing whenever he wanted to play, which was mostly with Wales. So something is broken in that relationship, something that will not be able to be cured. But there is a lesson for everyone. You don't call parasite somebody, not without really fully understanding what's going on in his head. And secondly, you have to look beyond whatever gestures Gareth Bale is doing. If he's doing it, and quite clearly he's now has got a vendetta against Real Madrid and his fans, he's doing it for a reason as well.
That's a very unpleasant situation, isn't it? The World Cup draw, Group E, Spain, Germany, Japan, Costa Rica or New Zealand. That's the group of death, is it?
I don't know. I was having a look at the in the FIFA rankings, the average of the teams in each group, and you know the one that looks the group of death is the England one. The
England,
average
USA, higher. Iran, and then you have either Scotland, Wales, Ukraine.
That's right. It's in terms of where they are in the rankings, they are higher than in the rest. So I would think that's the one. But surprisingly, in England, the reaction has been, yeah, we are in the next round. I think they're just going to have to be a little bit calm. But do you want the useless fact of the week? Do you know
Absolutely.
Who called the group of death? Right, group of death. Who called that for the first time and where?
Go for it.
Mexican sports writer Ángel Fernández, he deserves a mention here. It was in the 1970 FIFA World Cup, and it was a group that had England, the favourites Brazil, the runners-up of 62 Czechoslovakia and Romania. He called it the group of death, and since then we've been copying his expression.
Yeah, and everyone looks for the group of death, and the truth is there may not be a group of death. We have to find
yes.
one, don't we?
It happens. For instance, you look at Brazil, Serbia, Cameroon and Switzerland. Switzerland is really tough to beat. Brazil, yes, they're ahead, but who is going to be second on that one? So that could also be a group of death, or certainly one that the points will count a lot.
Yeah, of course, everyone's looking at the venue, aren't they? I mean, the human rights record, the fact that, you know, the conditions are going to be difficult there, even though, you know, it's going to be in the winter. Will all of that overshadow what's happening on the pitch in the World Cup?
I'm convinced it won't. There will be talk of it. I've got mixed feelings about this, and I want somebody to help me. Claire, help me. Because I am actually thinking, I'm going to Qatar and I know what's happened there and I read about it. But at the same time, do I have to place myself in the high pedestal and telling Qatar how they should behave when my country selling arms to Saudi Arabia, or when, you know, some of the things that they do in European countries and making in areas in the world, certain areas of the world, very unstable because of their political decisions. Do we have the right to go to Qatar and say, guys, this is not the way to do things? I don't know. I guess you can point at things. But
yeah, these are they're difficult questions. They're difficult questions, and there's no doubt they're going to be asked right up to and right over the period of the World Cup. One other issue I wanted to mention, Guillaume, with you. This world record attendance at the Nou Camp last week. Barcelona women's team beat their rivals in front of a record-setting 91,500 fans. Real Madrid, they were the opposition.
And the amazing thing, or the beautiful thing, was that who was in the stands? Young families with young girls, young boys that wanted to be part of a historical day. And certainly the result was important. And yes, Barcelona won. They were favourites anyway. This is the best team in the world, perhaps the best team ever. But you look back, and when there was the first Champions League, Barcelona didn't even have a professional team. And they were training in a pitch that's next to the Camp Nou that's used now to park cars. That's what they did. And now it's a professional site in a professional league, and things are certainly looking up. In fact, you're saying 91,553 were at the Camp Nou. That's more than went to see Barcelona-Real Madrid of men's in the Clásico. So it's good news, and they will play the semi-finals there against Wolfsburg too, and the opportunity to actually beat that record.
It's great to see. Guillaume, lovely to talk to you as always. Soccer journalist and pundit Guillaume Balaguer. We will chat again in a couple of weeks. Joining me next, Dr. David Nabarro of the World Health Organization. That's after the break.
Text 51551. Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.